Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and with me in the studio today is editor Simon Lambert. And this week, we talk property. Why now might be a good time to think about building your own home? Should pensioners get a stamp duty break for downsizing? And can you sell your house for a knockdown price to avoid care costs? Also today, time will prove me right, says Neil Woodford. Simon explains why he's not deserted the beleaguered fund manager. And the SUV penalty, how much picking a 4x4 will really cost you at the pumps. Clue, it's a lot. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.
But first, have you ever dreamed of designing and building your own home? Perhaps you've been inspired by TV shows such as Kevin MacLeod's Grand Designs. Well, you wouldn't be alone. But more and more people are turning that dream into a reality. The self-build business is booming, particularly among those near retirement, last year making around 15,000 homes. Now, that figure is expected to soar following measures to cut red tape. So what are the pros and cons? And how hard is it to do? Simon, firstly, have you ever dreamed of designing and building your own home?
I'd love to build my
would
own
you?
Home.
Where yeah, would it, what would it look like? Where would it be?
I live in London at the moment.
That's why I asked you, but where would it be? I can't imagine.
It wouldn't
you...
be in London.
Exactly.
Okay. Are the chances of finding a plot.
Yes.
If I could find a nice big plot in London to build my home, then yes, I'd go for it. No, it would probably be out of London. Ideally, when I think about building my own home, it's somewhere maybe in a village, in the countryside, on the edge of town. Ideally with a nice big garden, mm-hmm. overlooking fields. Perhaps a wood or something like that.
Would you go for something modern?
I would actually be very tempted to build something modern. I quite like something modern. I can see some glass. I can see some wood frames. I can see some really nice big windows, letting the light flood in. Nice big rooms. Yeah, I'd love to. I'd absolutely love to build my own home. It's something that has always appealed to me. I love watching things like Grand Designs or Ugly House to Lovely House and things like that. I mean, I don't watch them religiously,
no.
But I do enjoy watching them, and I like it when people do it. And what's always appealed is the fact that you get a house built to your specification, but more also to me is the idea of trying to do it with plenty of space. Now, unfortunately, the problem is that's not very easy in this country.
No, the plenty of space thing is an issue.
And actually just complicating the issue when you said whereabouts would it be. Now, I live in London, but I'm originally from Hertfordshire. Mm-hmm. My wife is also originally from Hertfordshire. If we were to move out of London, it would make sense to move in that direction where both my mum and my wife's mum still live in that direction. And that is prime commuter belt territory where you do not find large empty plots where you could get planning permission on which to build. What you do find is people buying existing houses and knocking them down. That is very expensive to do, though.
Well, there's the question then, isn't it? Because if there's no space, is it these 15,000 homes we're seeing? Is that knocking down old houses to build new ones? Because I would imagine any plots that are free would have been snapped up by developers.
No, it depends, actually, because if we look at just at the existing scenario at the moment, rather than the changes that are coming in, really it depends where you are. So, for example, if you're in a part of the country that isn't so populated and has more space, yes, it will still be hard to find land to build on outside of a town or a village. You know, you might find a plot on the outskirts, but you have stuff around, for example, you can't just go build a house in the countryside because of the rules around building in the Greenbelt, things like that. But you can find them and you can get planning permission, and some of the local councils are willing to release land or grant the planning permission. And what you can find sometimes is plots that are maybe an infill or an odd bit of land, or they had something on them before that wasn't a house that's now fallen down, a dilapidated barn or something like that. And if you're not in that commuter belt around our major cities, then that land has less value for housing. And it might be that the plot is too small for a builder to decide that it wants. If the plot is big enough to get a few houses on, you know, four or five houses on, chances are a builder's going to buy it. If the plot is only big enough to get one house on, then a builder might decide that it's not actually worth them doing that because there's an opportunity cost. If they decide to go just build one house there and then sell it on, they can't go build four or five houses on the plot they can find to build four or five houses. And actually, my uncle has just done this. So he lives in Herefordshire, where there is a lot more space than there is in North London or Hertfordshire. And he lived in a house that he's lived in for as long as I can remember, up the top of a hill. It's a steep hill. It's tricky to get to. And him and his wife decided that, seeing as they were getting older, they might need to move to somewhere a little bit more practical. They found a plot of land that they could build a house on. And my cousin is a carpenter. And so my cousin built the house for his dad. It looks amazing. And then my cousin bought his dad's old house. Built him his new house and bought his dad's old house.
Well, I was going to ask you that, because when we're talking about designing and building your own home, do these people who are making all these homes literally make the home themselves, or all just delegation, or is it a bit of a mix, a happy mix? Because in retirement, I think, ugh.
You need to be pretty handy to build it yourself. You do see people trying to build it themselves, don't you? Occasionally on the old grand designs, you'll see someone trying to build it themselves. But no, most people get builder in. And a lot of the time, when you see programmes like Grand Designs, people will decide to project manage it themselves. They might stop work for a year and project manage it. The problem is they may not have the experience in project managing, building. They're dealing with the tradesmen, with the builders, trying to get things in here and things in there. And you think, well, hang on, how can you give up work and do this? But then actually, if the money they're going to save on paying someone else to project manage it is worth the same or more than what their earnings would be for the year, then I suppose it makes sense. But no, it's a rare scenario where you'll find something like my cousin who is handy enough to actually be able to build a house. Normally, you get someone in to do it for you. There are some people who do it without an architect. There's some people in the story that we ran this week who did it without an architect. But if you go to some of these self-build shows, so there's the Grand Designs show, there's the self-building show, the home building and renovation show, there's all these things which are hugely popular at the moment. There are lots of companies there who are tailored towards doing this kind of thing for people. And that's where you'll get things like companies that can build you a prefab home. So one that's been built somewhere else and then they come and construct it on site. Or where you can sort of pick things off the shelf to mix and match and put your home together. I think one of the problems is, though, to go back to what we were saying, is this whole finding a plot thing. Mm-hmm. And what it means is that the parts of the country where homes are most expensive, it's obviously hardest to find the plot. And so this skews towards something that, as you said, it's more towards retired people who living, not necessarily needing to live near the major urban centres for work or for schools and things like that.
There's lots of reasons I can imagine that more people in retirement are doing this than younger people. I mean, time is one of them. Money is probably another one. Exactly. Although, in your article, it suggests that actually it can pay dividends to do it yourself. If, again, you have the time and the money up front, I imagine is probably a big issue. But what are the changes coming in, these cuts to red tape? That there's a prediction that this business, which is already booming, could get even bigger.
Yes. So what we're trying to do is essentially copy something that is really quite common in Europe, in many of the European countries. So we don't build that many homes ourselves, largely to do with the difficulty of finding plots and so on. Now, if you go to France, for example, you will see areas where there's lots of houses that have sprung up, new build houses, and the plots have been sold off, serviced for people to build a house on. So you go along, you buy the plot, which will come with the connected to the water, the electricity, the gas, and you build your home. And because there is already an industry doing this, you can build a home that's quite a bit like the other homes that have been built there. Won't look exactly the same, but will be done to your own specifications. And it's a relatively cheap way of getting a house built, particularly in those areas where you find the sort of breeze block constructed walls that are then rendered white with the orange roof the orange tiled roof. You know, you can, if you've been to France, to near the coast or rural France, you can picture these houses. And funnily enough, my parents did this years ago. When I was about 10, they bought a plot of land near the Atlantic coast in France, or on the Atlantic coast in France, and they built a house there, a holiday home. And we had it for 20 years before they sold it. But they had the plot that they bought. Mm-hmm. There was lots of different plots. They went, they looked at the plots, they chose the plot, and then they got someone to build the house. They did it to their own specifications, so however many bedrooms they wanted, how big they wanted it. There was obviously going to be a limit as to how big it would be due to the plot. And I remember both my mum and dad said that this was a relatively inexpensive way of doing it. So what we want to do is to try and emulate something like that here, and this is where the right to build register is coming in. And councils have been told that they have to find land for more homes at the moment. So they're all putting in these local plans and they're all finding land, and a lot of them are putting in plans to release land from the Greenbelt. And I would advise anybody who lives near the Greenbelt to find out what your council is doing. Engage in the consultation, because some of these councils are really not doing the most sensible thing that they could be doing, and they're doing the thing that's easiest. Or they're releasing the land nearer the poorer bit, the land nearer the less rich bits of town, so to say, and things like that. Might not be the most suitable land for building on, might not be the land that's closest to the stations or the schools or things like that, but it's the land that they can get away with releasing with a lot less influence from people. So engage in that. But as part of that, they've got this right to build register that came in April 2016, and councils have to have a register of people who are interested in self-build, and you can put your name down on that, and then when they release some land, they will get in contact with people and say, we're releasing some land, we're making these plots available, and presumably there's going to be more people who want the plots than plots, and there'll be some way of working out who gets them and how they get them. And they can't be, obviously, just auctioned off at the highest price.
Yeah. They all just go back, and you mentioned it with your family building their own home. I wonder how much, because I imagine that was quite some time ago.
Yeah.
How difficult it would be to do that now. I don't know if you know the answer to that, but just, is it going to be more difficult now? I mean, obviously we have Brexit looming and all that sort of thing, but that seems to me, if you're talking about land, if there's a problem in living in and around London, or indeed any major city in this country, or indeed just this country full stop, then actually going abroad, doing something like that might be an option to you. But is it still a viable option?
Well, it's still a viable option, and you still see these plots of land being released. But you've got to bear in mind that this is on the coast in a little tourist town that is very busy for 2 months of the year and then is pretty much dead for the rest of the year. So there's not a lot of employment going on there, apart from the seasonal employment. And so you'll find it much easier to do something like this if you are in a more rural area or somewhere further away from a town or a city. But still, they are doing this in not the suburbs of the towns, but the sort of outlying villages, the belt around them. They do still do this. And that's the idea with us doing this, is that we try to encourage more people to be building their own homes. So at the same time as you're going to see developers building lots of new homes, there will be the opportunity for people to build their new homes. Now, there are a couple of problems with this, I think, we should probably try to address. Mm-hmm. And in fact, with the whole plan to build lots of new homes, is firstly, one of the problems with the register is they're all run separately by the individual councils. So say, for example, I wanted to move back out to Hertfordshire and build my own home. Now, I might have to register with three or four different councils, because it might be that there's not a specific town I want to live in, but there's an area. So I draw a circle and I want to live within that circle. But that circle manages to cover three or four different councils with planning authorities. So, for example, in my scenario, it could be St Albans, Welland and Hatfield, North Harts. What causes an issue is a lot of the council's registers are free to register with. Some of them are charging people only a small amount, £15, £20, £25, something like that. But I have heard about councils charging people for it. And so then it's a bit speculative, isn't it? And you think, well, what are the chances of me actually getting a plot to build on? Do I really want to pay them £25? I want to have to pay the other one £25. And all of a sudden you've run up £75 or £100. But I guess if you're serious about doing this, maybe that's a way of putting a little bit of a barrier in place to make sure that people are serious. Because when they release these plots, as I said, they're going to have a problem. There's going to be a lot more people who want them than do them. And then the other issue is the size of the plot. Anybody with much experience of new build homes in this country will know that we build houses on plots that seem to have gardens that are too small for the house. Have you noticed this about houses, new build houses? It's not an issue with flats, really, is it? There is targets about the density of housing. That target on density goes back all the way back to the Brown-Blair government. I think it's too dense, because we're also talking about trying to follow the Garden City model of having more greenery, more space and everything like that. One of the great things about the Garden Cities was everybody had a decent-sized garden. And these two are bumping up against each other. Obviously means you can't build as many houses, but arguably if you're going to build a four-bedroom house, you want a decent-sized garden, not one of these ones that looks like it's on a postage stamp. You walk out you walk out the back door, you do three steps and you've hit the fence.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Although there will be some people listening thinking, God, having a garden, what a luxury that would be. But let's move on from this one, because I want to focus on a suggestion by Saga. You know, perhaps you're retired, you are thinking of downsizing. Should you have a stamp duty break? Because this is what Saga, the over 50 specialist, is calling for. They reckon that by cutting the cost of moving home for pensioners, we'll have a trickle-down effect benefiting all home buyers. Now, this is something that the government has wanted to encourage, has it not, Simon, for some time now? Why is that the case? And will it work?
Oh, it's just all these pensioners just clogging up all our big houses. Honestly, I mean, it's a nightmare.
How dare they? Get out of your own home.
How dare they? You know, they spent years paying for these houses and then they retire. They're not working. They've got no kids there anymore. And then they just sit there in these big houses. I mean, and quite often, they even use them to do things like look after their grandchildren or have people come and stay and visit. It's unbelievable.
I can see what you think about this, Simon.
No, look, there is a situation where you get lots of people who, once they retire, get into their pension years, they do actually decide that downsizing might make sense. I've spoken to any number of people in my parents' generation who've considered doing this, because they're in a big family home. Realistically, that once the grandchildren are at school, they're not there all the time, kind of thing. Even if they were looking after their grandchildren, how often do they have someone come to visit? It's like that classic thing of when you've got a spare room, which, if you've got a spare room and you're younger, it's probably a room you're going to need to be using. You don't just have a bed in it.
Right.
You know, it might be that you use it as a kind of dining room or something, or a study. And do you then spend the money on a decent sofa bed? But then you're like, I'm spending all this money, and how often do people actually stay on the sofa bed? Same thing. Imagine that with lots of spare rooms that have beds in them and other furniture. So there's a belief that if we can encourage these people to move, and that one of the reasons why they don't move is because it's too expensive to move. There's a belief that if we encourage these people to move, that will free up the properties. By more of those properties coming onto the market for sale, the people who would be buying them would have more choice. That would mean prices weren't so high, because wouldn't be so many people chasing a small number of homes. Those people buying those homes would then sell their own homes, and there would be a trickle-down effect that goes all the way down. And so we've had a stamp duty break for first-time buyers. Now we should have a stamp duty break for last-time buyers who are downsizing. Now, one of the criticisms of this is that if you are downsizing as a pensioner, you are going to be near the top of the property food chain. You're selling your larger home to buy a smaller one that's going to be cheaper, whereas normally people are doing the opposite.
Yeah.
They're selling their smaller home to buy a larger one that is more expensive. You are also the person who, you are also in amongst the group of people who have made the most money out of property over the years, because you will have likely, most likely bought when it was much cheaper. Now it is much more expensive. And so you would be getting a stamp duty break, but the young family trying to buy their second home, so not the first time buyers who have already got one, the young family trying to buy their second home or their third home, they wouldn't be getting a stamp duty break. I mean, maybe this is a good idea because it just ends up with everyone eventually getting a stamp duty break.
I was going to say, what is the point? What is the, if you can have breaks in something, then what is the necessity for it if it is causing so many problems. So we have a stamp duty break for first-time buyers because apparently it was the barrier for them to get on the property ladder. I think deposit also might have something to do with that. But also now, if you're talking about a stamp duty break for pensioners to downsize, surely they will be going into the homes, the smaller homes, the perhaps the flats, the one, the two-bedroom flats, the first-time buyers would be going for. So
with deeper pockets.
With the readies in hand.
Cash buyers.
Precisely. Yeah. So is this therefore trying to address, which we haven't done but we've spoken about in the past, the so-called second steppers and the third steppers, the clogging up the market? I mean, I don't know about this stamp duty thing, but it just sounds to me just get rid of the whole thing altogether. Is that ever viable?
Well, stamp duty, until Gordon Brown got his hands on it, wasn't really a major issue. It was just charged at 1% on all properties above
what
a certain price.
What is it? Let's go back to basics now. What is it actually literally for?
Well,
what they tell you it's for and what it actually literally goes for?
It's just a tax. It's an extra tax that was, as I said, a relatively small tax. It was imposed on transactions. It's effectively a transaction tax. Government gets a bit of money when people buy property. Stamp duty is also charged on share purchases as well. But it's nowhere near so much of as an issue there. The problem is, though, is that because the government, certainly Gordon Brown when he was Chancellor, then George Osborne after him, cashed in so much on the rising property market by raising this tax, that it then became a major issue. So it wasn't so much of a problem when house prices were just going up through the 2000s and mortgage lenders were throwing money at people and people were withdrawing lots of money from their homes, because in a rising market it's like, yeah, the tax is big, but my house is going up by more than that every year, I don't need to worry about it. But obviously then it just starts to ratchet and ratchet and ratchet and ratchet, and then it became a sort of soak the rich kind of thing. Impose it more on more expensive homes, tighten it on them because we can take some more money off them because people buying expensive homes are rich and therefore they're bad. And eventually it got to the point where George Osborne actually overhauled the entire tax, because it used to be levied as a slab. So you went up above thresholds, but then that percentage was charged on the entire property purchase price. So George Osborne made it marginal, like an income tax. So as you go above a threshold, you just pay the higher rate of tax on that higher chunk. But as he did that, because it was by then drawing in lots of money for the government, he didn't want to make it so that actually it was an overall reduction, and he would have been accused of helping rich people and so on. So he made it cheaper for a lot of people, removed some of the cliff edges in there that were caused by this slab star system, but made it more expensive for people further up the ladder. So people buying more expensive homes. So if above about a million, it got more expensive. Now, boo-hoo, those poor million-pound home buyers. But some of those million-pound home buyers are just people buying in really expensive areas who are already having to find loads and loads of money. You know, it might cost them 200 grand to move up the property ladder, 300 grand to move up the property ladder. They're then getting hit with, you know, 60, 70,000 pounds worth of stamp duty. And a lot of them have just, it's sort of stalled the market. They've stopped moving. Or perhaps just the sheer amount of money they need. But it's been accused of gumming up the market. It's a bad tax because it inhibits movement. Mm-hmm. It stops people from moving home, and it stops people from moving for employment because, you know, they might move to another part of the country, have to sell and buy their home and things like that. So realistically, we should probably just get... If we've decided it's so much of a problem that we're going to give first-time buyers a break and last-time buyers a break, we should probably just get rid of it. And there has been talk of getting rid of it and introducing a capital gains tax on residential property. So at the moment you don't pay any capital gains tax if you sell your own home, and so there's been talk of maybe imposing some form of capital gain on people, so people are paying a tax on profit they've made, whereas actually with stamp duty effectively what you're doing is paying a tax based on the profit someone else has made on that property.
So in sum, we're more likely to see stamp duty gotten rid of altogether and something else brought in than we are to have this additional, politically speaking.
I don't know.
Do you not think, politically speaking,
this would be a daft move, but that doesn't mean that it won't happen.
That's true. That is
We've definitely seen a number of them.
Yeah. I'll take it all back. Right, well, I just want to focus on one property-related question that you have from a reader, which I'm sure a lot of people will be thinking about. You know, perhaps you are thinking about selling or downsizing, and this is not me, so I'm just going to quote now. Our property is worth around £240,000. My husband and I were thinking about equity release, But the family don't like the idea. Now, if we were to sell the property to our two children for £70,000, as this is the figure we were thinking about for equity release, and they raise a mortgage on this amount, would there be any problems? I was thinking by doing this, as we would not own the house anymore, that if one of us were to go into a home, there would be no fees for us to pay. The answer, Simon. What is the issue here?
This is an old chestnut, that can I sell my house for less than it's worth to my family? Can I give it away kind of thing in order to avoid some form of payment or tax? The answer is no. Basically, the care element here is one thing, and then there's also a tax element to do with the sale. So Michael Culver, a board director at Solicitors for the Elderly, replied, and he said, selling a house to your children for less than it is worth isn't effective tax or care funding planning, and specialist legal advice should be taken, so alternative measures can be considered. If you went ahead with such a sale and either you or your husband needed to go into a care home, it's likely this would be seen as a deliberate deprivation of your assets. That deliberate deprivation is an official term. This means the sale would be disregarded, the home would still be considered to be your asset, hence you would be liable for the care fees. At an extreme, your local authority, which would otherwise be funding your care, would seek to have the sale overturned. There's no time limit on a local authority's ability to take action in these matters, so it wouldn't matter how much time had passed since the sale of your house. The same applies to any other gift you make to your children which is deemed to be deliberate deprivation. Technically, this house sale could count as a gift, as it would be done at a bargain price. If one or both of you go into a care home in the future and don't qualify for NHS continuing healthcare, you'd be deemed as self-funders when it comes to paying the bills, given the value of your property. That means you'd have to pay care costs until your assets, including the value of your home, were depleted to £23,250. Seems quite unfair, doesn't it? But what this
level,
is to do is to stop people giving away their home or selling it for a knockdown price and then continuing to live in it and benefit from it and then relying on state to pay for their care. You can give away your home and you can sell your home. Mm-hmm. You just have to be very careful about how you do it so that you're not seen to be doing it just to game the system. That's the really important bit. As long as you're not seen to be doing it just to game the system, then it's okay.
But that's hard to say, because you may want to gift your property or sell your property to your children. There may be lots of different reasons. I mean, if the property is worth £240,000, what is deemed to be an okay amount? So £70,000 too low.
Yeah.
Are we talking £200,000? £150,000?
There's also inheritance tax implications, stamp duty implications. Inheritance tax-wise, even if it was done at a reduced price, it would be seen as a gift between the market value and the reduced price. So if you give away that money, then as long as you live for 7 years, it's not liable for inheritance tax. But if you die within those 7 years, it will fall within your estate. Might be that the estate doesn't go over the inheritance tax threshold, particularly for a couple, where once you add in the own home allowance, that inheritance tax threshold is moving up towards £1 million and they've got a £240,000 house. But in terms of stamp duty, you would have to pay the rate that applies at the value of the property on the open market, not the £70,000 value. So that would make it more expensive in that sense. I guess if you were to give away the property and move out of it, or if you were to give away the property and pay market rent on the balance that you don't own now to your children, then that might swing things in terms of, for example, the tax man or the care scenario. But it's definitely, for people who are thinking about doing something like this, they do need to seek specialist legal advice, because whilst they might balk at paying some money for that solicitor to help them work out what they should do, it was likely to be considerably cheaper than getting it wrong and then suddenly finding out that they went to all this trouble and then they'd come after for tax and care costs in the end anyway.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Right, well, let's leave property to one side, because at one time it seemed his star would never wane. But times have proved tough of late for Neil Woodford. However, despite an admission that his performance had let savers down, the veteran fund manager says the stock market will boom after Brexit, even as he's ditched part of his investment strategy. Simon, you have a vested interest here, but firstly, what's been going on? Because it seemed a couple of years back we couldn't praise him enough. What's been going on?
Yes, Neil Woodford is Britain's superstar fund manager. There are some other star fund managers, but he is the largest of those star fund managers. And he was a fund manager for a company called Invesco Perpetual for many years. And he made those who invested with him over the long term lots and lots of money. And he also made himself something of a name for dodging some of the pitfalls along the way, mm-hmm. in particular the dot-com boom and bust, and the worst of the financial crisis as well. He left Invesco some years back to set up his own fund management company under his own name, Woodford. And he launched his own Woodford Equity Income Fund. And lots of people flocked to invest. Mm-hmm. And in fact, ironically for a man who, one of the reasons given for him leaving his old job and setting up his new job was that the fund that he was running was just too big, and it made it difficult to make investment decisions. I mean, when you are running an investment fund that runs into the billions in the assets that it holds, even if you buy a company that is only a small percentage of your fund, for example, a 2% holding in your fund, you're buying a pretty big chunk of that company and you're having to buy a lot of shares, and it starts to become actually quite difficult to buy into companies and build positions. So a smaller fund is more nimble. Ironically, Woodford left, set up his own fund, and then his new fund became anything but small. But it's good news for Neil Woodford and his fund management company because they're making lots of money. And things went quite swimmingly for a while. He launched an investment trust as well, this Patient Capital Investment Trust, which was, he's got a real interest in early stage businesses, particularly university spin-outs and those involved in healthcare. Mm-hmm. These are considerably more risky. Some of them are could pay off, not pay off kind of investment, rather than the big, steady, dividend-paying firms that he's been famous for investing in. So he set up his Patient Capital Trust. He set up another fund, which was a sort of higher income fund. But things started to go wrong. The decisions that he had made, the things that he had invested in, didn't do well. There were a number of high-profile companies that blew up. Capita, Provident Financial, he was an investor in the AA as well. Even one of the smaller companies that he heavily invested in that did spectacularly well for a while, and floated on the stock market, did spectacularly well for a while, Purple Bricks, the online estate agent, that has had an absolutely torrid time over the last year or so. Its shares have lost 60-something percent in value. I think, actually, Woodford's still up on that one because he was in so early. But it doesn't look so good. And investors have started to pull their money out. So billions of pounds have gone out of his big fund, and he's come under a lot of criticism. He's come under criticism for his investment decisions, for not changing tack, for putting more of his flagship fund's money into small, unquoted, more risky companies than the big, old-fashioned dividend payers. And there's two schools of thought. One is Woodford's completely lost his touch and he was always overhyped and anyway. And there's another one, which is he's come good in the past. He has an extremely long and illustrious track record, and he's sticking by his guns, and he's right to stick by his guns, and people should stick with him.
Was another argument to that, so if, you know, he's lost his touch or he hasn't lost his touch, you should stick with him. Is the third one saying that, you know, perhaps he's trying something different because this is, you know, his name to it. He's trying new things that he hasn't done before. Are you noticing that? Or has he just been supremely unlucky with some of the areas that he's invested in?
And I don't think he's hidden any of it. He's not really hidden any of this stuff. There's been suggestions he's had too many, you know, that the fund has skewed too much towards smaller, more risky companies and without investors realising and things like that. I don't know. I think if people are engaged with the notes that the Woodford company puts out and the things that he says and listens to what he says, I think it's clearly obvious he's really interested in that stuff. He publishes a full list of the fund's holdings, so you can look through it and see. And not many funds regularly publish a full list of their holdings. It's some of the companies that he's invested in have just been, in his note that he put out last week, he said have been out of favour. So what's happened since Brexit is the UK stock market had a bounce when the pound fell and people bought in because they were buying up these big overseas earning companies that once the money is translated back from dollars or euros into pounds and pence, the fall in the pound flatters their earnings. But overall, the UK has been in the slow lane and the bungling over the past year has definitely not helped. Now, his argument is that he thinks a Brexit deal is more likely to be done than not, that he sees the chance of a no-deal Brexit as having receded into the background, that he thinks there will either be Theresa May's deal, less likely, or a soft Brexit with a close relationship with Europe, more likely. Once this is done, sterling will rise. The sentiment towards the more UK-focused companies that he is a big investor in will rapidly turn about, and people will start buying into those, and they'll be less interested in those big overseas earning FTSE companies that he says have been driven more by circumstance. And so he says that he focuses on valuation, and the market has been driven by momentum, but that ultimately valuation always shines through, buying things that are not expensive, and that he believes that he will be proved right in the end.
And you, because you have vested interest in this.
And me. Tell us. I wrote my column about this week. Now, while I would agree with Woodford's sentiment here and also point out that he's a better investor than I will ever be, with far greater experience, resources, etc., I would question some of his judgment on some of these companies. And that would lead me to question my judgment on why would I want to still remain invested in the fund. Companies like Capita, Provident Financial, AA, I mean, they were accidents waiting to happen. Mm. There's massive political risk around the outsourcers like Capital and Provident Financial, a doorstep lender, which has been a very good investment for many years. But there's a lot of political risk around a company like that, and it's always exposed to something going wrong. And the AA was, you know, loaded up with debt by its previous owners. And so, yeah, maybe those are accidents waiting to happen. So maybe I think with the high-profile flagship Woodford Income Fund, I should have looked at that and gone, do I really want to be invested in this? There's an opportunity cost. Would I be better off just investing my money into another fund? Would I be better off putting my money into the Linsell Train Fund? Mm-hmm. Nick Train's another manager who has a sort of value dividend kind of approach. With the Patient Capital Trust, I think that's different. I invested in that because of this thing about Woodford backing these smaller university spin-out healthcare type companies, and that actually I think that he might have something there, and the clue is in the name, patient capital, be patient. So that I have no problem with, and I bought that at a discount to its share price, because investment trusts can trade at a premium or a discount. So I'm not that bothered that I stuck with him. If I hadn't stuck with him for the equity income fund, though, I'd definitely have more money if I'd put the money somewhere else. The patient capital one, I'm just being patient. He finished his note by saying that he thinks that the end of 2019 and 2020 will be very interesting as this Brexit thing plays out. It will also be very interesting for those people like me who stuck with Woodford and those people who ditched Woodford, because ultimately, over that year and a half, we're going to find out if he's right or not.
You will indeed.
Because I think that is it. Once we start to get to the end of 2020, if he can't still be saying these things. Is he right or not? That's going to be the crunch point. We shall see.
Again, yeah, we shall see. We're going to leave that to one side. We shouldn't really talk about accidents waiting to happen, because we're going to talk about cars now. SUVs, the fastest growing of all car types in Britain right now. We love them for their high safety standards, their raised driving position, and according to your motoring correspondent, Rob Hole, their chunkiness. What the hell's the chunkiness? Is it literally they look chunky?
Yeah, people just like the Tonka truck kind of look,
the
isn't
chunkiness.
It?
The chunkiness.
Although they're a bit more blobby than Tonka truck nowadays, aren't they? They're just a sort of
I'd love Rob to
large
write these
blob
in his next article. Blobbiness, Tonka truck, yeah. So it's chunkiness. That's why we like it, apparently. The downside, is the extra you pay at the pumps. Owners of 4x4s spend up to £1,600 more for fuel over 4 years compared to a similar size regular car. Now, reading this, a lot of people might think, that's not a massive surprise that, you know, you pay more at the pumps for an SUV. Is it the amount that you're paying more? Or the way it's calculated, or the accuracy?
No, it's just going to cost you more in fuel because you are driving a bigger,
yeah, but isn't
heavier,
that obvious? No offense, Rob.
Less aerodynamic car. But often you're driving a bigger, heavier, less aerodynamic car that doesn't have any more room inside. Mm. So people's justification often for buying an SUV is, well, I need the space. I've got the family. I need the space. I need the space for the kids and all their stuff. It's just so easy. It just swallows everything we need. Arguably, you'd be better off with an estate car. An estate car uses less fuel. There's much room for the passengers, as much room in the boot, if not more. They tend to be cheaper and they tend to use less fuel. And no, but it's not as chunky. And also they don't have that high driving position. And people get addicted to that high driving position. Now, a lot of these SUVs won't even be 4x4s. A lot of them will be two-wheel drive. So they don't even have that excuse. Yeah. So you might as well.
In my defence, that is why I bought one. But mine is a back injury.
Yeah, I mean, you have a specific reason for that, don't you?
And you always should have your bum above your knees, etc., for the most option for your back.
Look, I've driven lots of these large SUVs in my role as This Is Money editor and, you know, motoring editor. We get test cars in, and I've driven plenty of these SUVs. I've driven a Range Rover Sport all the way to the Alps and back. And do you know what? I'm not a big fan of big SUVs, but a Range Rover Sport is a very comfortable car to do a couple of thousand miles in. I recently drove a Volkswagen Touareg. A Volkswagen Touareg is a Volkswagen's large 4x4. The world does not need another large 4x4. Volkswagen could have quietly retired the Touareg from its range, and the world would have been perfectly happy, because they could also buy an Audi Q7 instead, which is also made by the same, effectively the same company, because Volkswagen Audi is the same group and so on. But it was a very good car and it was very comfortable to waft along in. And yes, that high driving position and everything is great. But there is something else that we should think about with these large SUVs. And the fact of the matter is if they are using more fuel over the years and costing you more money, they are also worse for the environment.
Yes.
They are contributing more to climate change by burning more fuel over the same period. And do you know what else they're worse for as well?
Parking.
Yeah, they're hard to park.
Sorry.
Potholes.
Oh,
yes. Yeah. Potholes. They contribute to potholes. Bigger, heavier cars, more damaging to our roads. I would still argue that the council's not fixing the roads might be the main contributor towards potholes, but Britain's love of an SUV is not helping.
So is it still worth it then with all that? Damage to the environment, bad for parking, bad for potholes, really expensive for fuel, apart from if you've got a back injury?
I mean, you're not selling it, really, but it's personal choice, isn't it? And I think there's lots of people out there who like them, and who would I be to deny them owning one? It's just, it will use more petrol.
There you go. You have to pay more for it. But
you know what? That is the thing that we should really be making the push for on electric. So we're saying no more diesel and petrol cars after, you know, 2040, or bring it forward to 2030. I think we should bring in a rule that says no more diesel and petrol SUVs after 2025. They all have to be electric. If we can have these big, heavy cars, make them all electric.
If you want to have some views on that, do get in contact with Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.com/podcast, where you can see all the articles and comment in reader comments.
Yes, you can indeed. And you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you do like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.